Hey creatives, you're listening to The Truth is Golden, a podcast produced by Revelator Studio and hosted by yours truly. My name's Arno, welcome to this episode. It is a show about creative minds, what makes them tick, their successes, failures, and everything in between. It is for people who are interested to learn more about creativity and its potential to make the world a better place.
Jason Bakker is a designer, certified foulmouth, and co-founder of Good Fucking Design Advice. A couple years ago, he taught a creative retreat that I attended, which is where the idea of this podcast came from. Jason is an eloquent, selfless, and engaging creative. Dive into his interview to learn more about what moves him.
Follow us on our website at rvltr.studio.
So today I have the pleasure to count Jason Bakker as our distinguished guest. Jason is a designer, unapologetic foulmouth, and co-founder of Good Fucking Design Advice. Thanks, Jason, for being on the show. It's a real treat to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a little more about who you are and what you do?
Yes. Who am I and what do I do? At the moment, I am the ex-co-founder of Good Fucking Design Advice, but we can get into that a little bit later. And in the moment, I am a practicing design consultant. I think often I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing as well, especially on a freelance front.
Well, here's your opportunity to flesh that out. How did you end up in the field and working as a designer?
I ended up in the field like I think a lot of young designers do, or people who are interested in art or creativity, whereas they realize at some point in their experience that being a fine artist really is not a lucrative career path. And I think especially in the U.S. culture, making money and making a living is probably too often forced upon people at a young age. Once I had that realization, I was led to what was then called by my art teacher commercial art, which just seemed like art for money. and that later became what we know as graphic design or visual communication design. Studied that in college for quite a long time. Actually ended up going to the same college for a second degree in graphic design to finish out what I consider a life sentence, 7.5 years consecutively studying graphic design. Finished at Kent State University in Ohio with my MFA. And while I was there, I also spent 5 years teaching at a university, the same university that I went to school. So I spent an enormous amount of time there kind of getting my feet wet, diving into graphic design as a practice, as a culture, and kind of the different myriads in which it can be used as a tool and a problem-solving device. But that's how I found my way in and what the journey was like.
I want to talk a little bit about the transition from your student days to Good Fucking Design Advice, which we can probably shorten as GFDA going forward because I don't want to have too many fucking words in my interview. But how did that come about? And how did you meet your partner, Brian?
Yeah, so previous to getting in graduate school, Brian, who was a semester ahead of me, obviously then would graduate ahead of me. He would always come and bother me in my last semester and ask me when I was going to graduate. Now, at the time, Brian coming to bother me about when I was coming to graduate, he was not really a friend at that point. He was just this guy who was kind of annoying, bothering me about finishing college. As time went on, Brian and I actually became good friends. I later would graduate undergrad, and Brian would then become a practicing professional. Later, we found ourselves both in graduate school, and we became very good friends in the sense that every day before or after class, we would share kind of our complaints or successes in the classroom. This was my first semester as, I don't know if you could even call me a professor, but I was instructing a group of freshman students. And I always chose the really early classes. I felt like I'm already a morning person and I could do a lot of good in that regard. I remember very clearly waking up at like 5:30 a.m. to teach a 7:45 class. So I would get up and I would walk to the university so that I would be wide awake and ready to like really inject these students with all the design knowledge I had. And every day I'd bring it to these students. And about 2 weeks into the first class, I just started really feeling a sense of fatigue. And it was basically centered around the idea that no matter what brilliant knowledge I brought to my students, it just often went over their heads, right? There was like, even if I gave them the best piece of advice, they didn't recognize it as advice. And that really started to drive me crazy. So I brought my frustrations to Brian, who at the time had only been teaching really a semester more than me. And largely as a result, he became kind of the person that I shared all my gripes with. And we took a little bit of a walk. In that walk, we came up with the idea to launch GFDA. And it was basically, how can we give students the advice they need and make them listen? And it kind of went back to the same idea that in grade school, when your teacher uses profanity, you'd never forget it, right? When she drops the F-bomb on accident, it's like stuck with you. It's carved in stone in your memory. And we felt like if we took design advice and used the F word, we had like this magic recipe for opportunity.
What was the initial intent behind GFDA?
The initial intent behind GFDA was to create a platform, a place that had advice for practicing designers, whether or architects, really anyone creative who needed a degree of motivation, and deliver it with something that is memorable. And we call that the hook, right? And we say that profanity is the hook that captures your attention. So we just initially really thought that the idea of putting profanity in everything was childish and funny. And it was a way for us not to take ourselves too seriously and a way for people to kind of find the advice in a memorable fashion. And so we launched the site with 25 pieces of advice. I think it was up for a month and we had 3.1 million page views. So to us, we really, the internet kind of paid way more attention to it than we ever had planned. I mean, we just made this site as a joke. It was something that we laughed. Brian and I both calling each other's bluff when we were creating it. It was a lot of kind of back and forth, like this is the dumbest, possibly the dumbest thing we've ever made. But we really just enjoyed the experience of actually executing that really dumb idea. It turned out to be what I did and what Brian still does for almost 7 years for me and, you know, almost 8.5 for him. So
from what I understand, it was literally an overnight success, correct?
I think that's probably the most adequate way to describe it. We always joke that Brian and I shared it with our 30 collective Facebook friends at the time. this very early days is 2010. And that was all the marketing we did other than turn it on. So, you know, I think by the third day we had 70,000 visitors. So yeah, it was an overnight success.
So what do you attribute that success to? What in your mind was the thing that caught the attention of the cultural psyche and made it so palatable for so many people?
Well, I don't know if it was palatable for so many people. Actually, the response from people that had visited the site was quite mixed. I think majority of people really appreciated the profanity. I think they saw it as here's advice that I can relate to, but now I appreciate it more. A lot of other people had strong opinions, and we got a lot of hate mail when we launched. Especially after traffic really increased and the site went around and made its rounds, I think they really felt like we did the design industry a disservice. I remember one quote specifically, someone said that we had set the entire design industry back 10 years by producing this artifact. And well, I think being only like 20, 25 at the time, I felt like I was so young to have made such movement in any one direction, you know, like the design industry, I haven't seen it move anywhere. So if I've moved it back, you know, 10, that's incredible. I really felt like I made a massive contribution.
Yeah.
What made it really favorable for people was that it didn't take itself too seriously. And I think oftentimes design is seen as this thing that is very strict and very serious. And that's not what we were at all when we launched GFDA.
Are the polarized opinions still true to this day, or people are more prone to appreciate it now that it's been around for a while?
If nobody hates you, nobody loves you. And I think that is a very true quote or a way to think about GFDA. People are always going to be offended by the profanity. And in some ways, that's when people ask, what do you do or what's the name of your business? And you tell them and they frown immediately, you know that they're probably not the type of people you want to continue having a conversation with or carry on with or going to maybe even think eye to eye when it comes to other ideas. I think in a lot of ways, this is how we kind of suss out clients who are going to be the right people to work with.
In my opinion, and I do a lot of work around this, I think this is brilliant positioning because positioning repels as much as it attracts, as you just said. Was there ever an intention to be that way at the beginning, or you were just two guys having fun and it just took a life of its own?
Looking back, I wish I had some really sophisticated answer around metrics and data about why we made what we made, but it really was just two guys having fun with the impetus of this classroom experience that I had had and Brian had been able to kind of share and relate to. And that was it. I mean, we just felt like there's got to be a way to help share the wisdom that we've kind of gathered over our many years as students and disperse it to the masses. And the internet was this place where things could be built overnight. It didn't require us to do anything really other than copy and paste. You know, we could have a site and business up and running in no time.
So let's talk a little bit more about your future instead of your past. And I'd like to hear about how that whole experience has shaped you, in what way, and how you're going to take that into your future work or have taken it into your ongoing work.
So I think the GFDA experience, my time there, really helped me to better understand how valuable it is to be serendipitous or to employ that as a means of generating ideas. If Brian and I in those moments had just laughed at that idea and put it on a shelf, I know that my career would have been dramatically different. But we recognized something in that moment that was going to continue to serve us time and time again. And that was this emotional reaction we had to that idea. And that's something I think about and really have been able to tune myself into, both in that experience and working with other people, is recognizing what a crazy or even great idea does to people when they first hear it. And that's something that I definitely carried on into my practice as a consultant and as a graphic designer. I think a lot of what we do is to delight people, and GFDA really was kind of a school in how do we continue to build this product beyond the advice and continue to deliver really practical, smart things in a witty, irreverent way.
What would you like the future of design to be? Like in an ideal world, what's your, how would the profession evolve?
That's a very serious question. How would I like the profession to evolve? Anyone who's been in the field as a practicing designer, maybe this could even be said about architecture as well, but I can't necessarily speak to that. But as a practicing designer myself, the ways in which we try to define our industry, I think, are constantly being broadened, but in a way that almost weakens our ability to deliver value. It's very interesting in that technology continues to kind of broaden that gap and change how we define what we do. So in an ideal scenario, I think we would spend more time kind of digging down and being more specific about how design can improve or create opportunity or value for other people.
I've been following a fairly well-known designer, Mike Montero from Mule. He talks a lot about the ethical responsibility of designers to own the impact of their work onto the world. And he uses the Facebook example all the time of certain design decisions and policies coming out of Facebook that have been impacting negatively some users, because there's this famous example of this girl that was a closeted lesbian and was accidentally outed by Facebook due to some changes in privacy settings. And he claims that to a company like Facebook, those people are statistical outliers because they're a fraction of a percent. But when your user base is 2 billion people, a fraction of a percent is still thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. So those statistical outliers still represent a huge amount of people in absolute terms. And for any one of us, it's more people than we'll ever know. And he really calls for people to start owning the impact of those design decisions, because they're critical, right? Is that something you've ever thought about?
Yeah, that is, especially when the hate mail started coming in. But in those moments, I think I was more interested in launching the idea. And I thought probably less about the negative impact it was going to have on people and the fact that they were going to be offended by it, and more about how it could potentially inspire or motivate someone to pursue or seek out opportunity. I think after it was all said and done, and even many years later, I was always deeply saddened to learn that some people were offended by the advice, you know, and that was something that it was always unfortunate. I felt like, you know, when someone tells you that you've done something to set the industry back 10 years, you think, yeah, partially that's on him or her, but partially that's on me. But at the end of the day, I don't think that we did anything wrong. I think no matter what you create, I think it could be always taken one or two ways.
Well, and I think it's, in your case, it's a little bit different, because what you did might have offended people, and that's understandable, because we were talking earlier about being polarizing, and having opinions is bound to polarize at one point or another. And our common friend James Victoria talks very eloquently about that. But I think it's different from making decisions that inadvertently affect people's life without their control. And you pointed out something very true, is that you can't control people's reaction. And the guy who might have said, you set the industry back 10 years, first of all, that's his opinion, and it's nothing more than an opinion, and the reaction is entirely on him as well, because he just reacted to words you guys put out. So I don't think you can compare the two scenarios in that sense, but it's a very interesting thing to think about.
In that same breath, you know, sometimes people would criticize the product more than the advice, or they would come and say, oh, you guys have done a lot, but it's definitely over, right? Like, what are you guys going to do next? I think more than people being offended by what we were doing, that kind of reaction really fueled our fire. And Brian and I really like thrived on those comments. We were like, you think we're done? Like, wow, we are going to really surprise you with what we have coming out, or like what we have coming up. I think those are things that really sparked more GFDA for us.
What would be the one or two of your best memories from being part of that adventure? Like the most inspiring things that have come out of being part of GFDA?
Yeah, I can think of two things, really. One, the launch in itself, just producing something that had such a small amount of really deep consideration, and just seeing the massive outpouring of people for that first 3 to 6 months every day just getting on and seeing followers and comments and people interact with your product, and you're spending countless waking hours dumping everything you have into it. I don't think there's any greater high of inspiration than watching people globally take hold of something you've made and make it their own, or fall in love with it. And I think that was really an incredible experience, and in some ways something I'm constantly chasing too. You know, it's like once you've had a taste of it, kind of from time to time, you get a little bit of it here and there, but you're always like, you know, you hope that one day you'd find yourself in that same position, because it really is truly unique, especially for designers, I think. And then the other one is in 2013, Brian and I, after some travel to a few different conferences, decided to actually set out on our own speaking tour. We did a 53-day long speaking tour. We hosted 26 events all over the United States, 11,000 miles, and we did the entire thing in a 1972 Dodge van that was we bought off eBay. And we saw it really as two things. One, to prove to people that you could start something from nothing, and really, and we're just like a living example of how far you can take a crazy idea. And I think that really inspired a lot of people. And the other part of that trip, which was so inspiring, was meeting designers and other practicing professionals from all over the country, face to face, hearing their stories, being part of their community for the night, and just learning about like how does design take shape in all those different kinds of environments and spaces. Just, I don't think that, again, it was kind of a really unique opportunity to go out and just meet the people that had been following us and supporting us face to face. It was really incredible.
And so it's interesting to hear you talk about the tour, because I had a question in the back of my mind. I think it's perfectly timed. Is there a GFDA community as a result of what you've guys done, like something that is beyond the two of you and kind of takes a life of its own? Or is it still kind of stuck in the stage of we sell products and people are inspired by it, but there's no like community to speak of? Or is it somewhere in between?
I would say it's somewhere in between. There's no literal community to speak of. And I think largely that's the cobbler's child goes barefoot kind of scenario, where Brian and I run a very lean operation, and oftentimes things suffered as a result because of that. I would say that if we did have a community, it consists of two parties. One, the close-knit friends and family we've made along the GFDA journey, and two, kind of the repeat customers and followers and fans that constantly follow and support and pay attention to everything we do. It's the same few thousand people that you see follow or comment on your social media kind of persistently over time. Maybe this conversation will spark me to encourage Brian to start that Slack channel that I've been begging him to kind of take advantage of. But yeah, I think the next phase for GFDA is really going to be an interesting one. I don't know, that product is always in the future of that company. I think that there's some social capital in its future, and I think there's a broader opportunity to take advantage of that.
You spoke a couple of minutes ago about that high you've gotten from the initial response to GFDA. How are you trying to bring that back into your life in the work you're doing now? Or are you trying at all?
I would say I'm trying. I am, you know, as a freelance consultant, you're always looking for the right kind of client and the right kind of fit. And a lot of that is someone you can grow with. You know, I obviously try to avoid the jobs that are just really project to project. If there's some situation or opportunity or organization that is on a path that is one I'm aligned with, I think that gets me closer to the goal of finding that deep, intense passion and motivation to see something through.
I can relate to that, because it's trying to do something very similar in a different space. But the focus of Revelator in the last year and a half has really shifted from project to project to really finding long-term clients that I can help grow and grow along with as well. I'll be a little more vulnerable than I'm comfortable with here, but at the end of the day, and I think you can relate to that, nobody really knows what the fuck we're doing, and we're just kind of trotting along and trying to figure out how to make shit happen. And but that's part of the excitement, I think. It's when a client asks you to do something you're not comfortable with and you say, yeah, I'll take it on, and you know that there might be a risk of failure. I think that's exhilarating, at least for me.
Yeah, I think there has to be a degree of people, or you or I, being willing to embrace that unknown. James does a really good job in summarizing this. He says some projects are for God and some projects are for money. And as someone who consults and has a number of different clients all the time, one of them being James, I do definitely recognize the God and money scenario and where my projects lie. Obviously, to get religious on my projects would be fantastic if I could be, you know, in the complete scenario where the projects I'm doing are just solely feeding my intense passion for graphic design. That would be incredible, but that's not the case. You know, I have to mow the grass and pay the bills just like everybody else. And oftentimes designing the phone book is the only way to do that. Not that I'm actually literally designing the phone book, but it is a large book and I imagine it's probably a terrible job.
So I want to go back in time a little bit and talk about your youth. Can you tell us what you were like as a kid?
Yeah, as a kid, man, how young do you want to go? I grew up at my family's business. My dad is second generation owner of paint and wallpaper business. So growing up, a lot of my daycare or childcare was definitely spent there, looking over his shoulder as he made paint. We spent a lot of time kind of climbing boxes and exploring anything we could get our hands on in the back storage room. But yeah, it was just a lot of painting, a lot of being creative, a lot of being on the ground floor of a family business. As I grew older, I even remember being probably about 10 years old and selling wallpaper to customers as they came in. You know, I really felt like the wallpaper sales area was my domain, even as a young child. Just knowing all the different patterns in the books and where to look and where to direct people. I think even as a young adult, it's something that served me. And if you're going into pitch a project, being able to read a situation, you know, it was the same as if you saw a customer come in. You could kind of size them up and tell whether they were stripes or lemonade pitchers on their wallpaper. You just kind of knew these things. Other than that, I you know, I would say I was really inspired by my grandmother. She's actually still around today. I feel incredibly fortunate to have a great relationship with her. But she was a practicing artist, professional artist. And just seeing the way in the life that she had and the work that she did, the fact that, you know, you could go see her work in galleries and in other places. It was really a remarkable experience to have as a young person. And it gave you a sense of that as a potential reality.
A little further about your childhood. Were you raised with a foul mouth?
No, I definitely remember very clearly what it was like coming home to my mom and saying, hey, Mom, like last week I launched this website and now it has tens of thousands of visitors and is growing by the day. And here's what it's called. And my mom, I would have to check with her again, but I think in those brief moments, she might have mistaken that good fucking design advice name for like an amateur pornography website. She was kind of torn in those moments. She was like, okay, so my son is somewhat, I guess, finding internet success in this thing. But at the same time, why did he have to choose profanity? You know? Funny story, actually, you know, as we grew and we started selling products, obviously the next thing we had to do was get a bookkeeper. And that was a big deal for us. And my mother had definitely been well-versed in the bookkeeping arena, having done the books for my dad for so long. My first hire was, outside of Brian, was my mom. And she was our bookkeeper for a number of years. Then eventually, I just felt like the relationship between my mother and I had kind of just turned into purely business. You know, like when mom calls, she has tax questions. When mom calls, she wants to talk payroll. You know, it was like, I just want to talk cookies and milk, Mom. Like, let's get back to being mother and son. Eventually I fired my mom and then realized that really she was doing a great job and it sucked using other people. It sucked using automated services and ended up hiring her back. She renegotiated a higher salary. Of course, you know, I definitely pushed back, but she prevailed and she worked for a little while longer. We ended up firing her again. So we had fun with that. Family and business are a very tough, tough thing to marry together. And in that same vein, I'm very lucky that I've made both a very good friend and I would say brother of Brian. And we've been able to really maintain a great relationship both in and out of GFDA. I think that's part of the reason we found our success so early on in the beginning, and we've continued to find success in pretty much every path we pursue.
How hard is it to fire your own mom?
Easier than you'd think, especially when, you know, she never really relying on GFDA as her sole income, but I definitely think she wanted to be a part of the party, and GFDA was that opportunity to like kind of be on the ground floor of the internet excitement that we had going on a day-to-day basis.
Can you talk a little bit about where you grew up and how that might have influenced your adult life?
I grew up in a small town in Ohio, Northeast Ohio, called Warren, Ohio. And actually, the town I grew up in was just a small township of that, and it was called Champion, Ohio. Champion wasn't necessarily rural. It was somewhat of like a suburbia. And being a part of that community meant we probably spent too much time running around outside and riding our bike. Being in an environment where building a log fort was more exciting than playing video games was a great way to describe our childhood. I was lucky enough to be in a neighborhood with a lot of different kids. I would say that that really helped to inform ingenuity and creativity and pretty much everything that we played or did or decided to do with our time.
At which point, if there was any, did you know you wanted to do graphic design?
There was a art history professor who stopped me after class. It was my second semester as a college freshman. And she said, Jason, I want to talk to you. And I never really had any one-on-one time with this particular professor. And she said, I see that you are studying art history as a major and you want to pursue art education. And she said, I just, for some reason, I don't know why she felt compelled to talk to me, but she just said, I think that there's other paths for you. And I don't know what that is, but I know art education field is shrinking and art history is a definitely difficult career choice. Maybe she saw that I was going to suffer in those avenues of profession. And in those moments, I was like really taken back because I felt so certain about that decision. And I went to the library at the college campus and I sat down and I remembered hearing about this graphic design program that they also had at the college on a different campus. But I also remember in the back of my head, my art teacher from high school telling me about this career field called commercial art. And again, in those moments, I put those pieces together and I was on this website for the school. And I visited the Kent State University School of Visual Communication Design website. And it was like nothing I'd ever seen at that time in my life. It was this minimal use of white space. It was just such fine typography and so many very seriously considered decisions. And this site spoke to me in every single way. And I knew in those moments that I absolutely had to be a part of whatever cult had built this website. And so like as fast as I could print the papers off and run to the admissions office, I had like changed my major in those moments. And I knew for a fact that I was on the right path. to cement that even further, day one of, I don't know, many years of graphic design education, I remember my professor coming in, and just in those first few breaths, I was like, this guy, like, I respect him already. Those are definitely the halcyon days of my college career.
There's always one or two of those professors that the minute you meet them, they're like, they make a difference. And then you forget all the other ones. Yeah, I've had a few of those myself. Speaking of professors, are you familiar with the website Rate My Professors?
I am. I haven't looked in a while, but I know I do have a profile there.
I want to do a little fun exercise for a couple of minutes just to lighten the mood a little bit. I went on there just for fun to check it out. I don't even remember how the idea came to me, but I thought it would be fun. Let's review some ratings and then you can tell us what you think.
Okay.
The first one I read was overall quality 4, so it's rated out of 5, and level of difficulty is 5.
Mm.
And the comment is definitely a teacher that encourages figuring out things on your own, shows tons of passion for the topics, has an entertaining, dry sense of humor. Overall, hard to read sometimes, but very helpful. Also, very attractive.
Mm. I think that student definitely got an A in my class, and that description alone nails it. I can just remember the kind of courses that a student would give me that kind of criticism for. But I was always one of those professors that made every effort to present course curriculum in a way that really forced the student to think. I was never going to give students the answers they wanted, because that's not how they learn. I always, if I could, presented a learning opportunity.
There's a number of other reviews. We're not going to go through them all, but based on what I've read, that seems pretty true. Another one that's interesting is overall quality is 2.5 and level of difficulty is 4. And the comment is, he doesn't tolerate slackers in the slightest. Can be a bit harsh sometimes. He's a good guy, though, and know his stuff. Just be prepared to work and really impress him with experimentation in your designs. I thought that was a really interesting one.
Yeah, that was probably a student from the 7:45 a.m. class. You know, you got to be on time. You chose this early class. Jeez, love those criticisms.
Yeah, I remember when I was in college, it was the same. We had like 8 a.m. classes, and I was probably one of two to bother showing up on time. And it would just be so frustrating to see other people just slowly walk through from like 8:30 to 9 and just not give a shit about the work. It was really funny.
Yeah,
I would get really pissed at the time. I would probably laugh nowadays. But interestingly, most of those guys are the ones who never got a job in the field either. So there's some justice somewhere.
I don't know any school that would. I think 7:45 is designed for people to fail. I don't think that's like a real time that people actually should come to class. And whoever sets that schedule up clearly had some vindictive personality. They were just like looking for students just to not to be on time. So it was easy to be a slacker. Easier to slack than it was to actually follow through.
So I want to talk a little bit about creativity, and we've already talked about it in a roundabout way, but I'd like to ask you what's the importance of creativity in your personal life, and what's your creative practice, so to speak, like?
Oh, so I thought there was more to that question. What does creativity mean to me in my life? I think it's really the root of everything I do. It's less of an idea and more of a philosophy, and something that you either live and understand or you're struggling to figure it out, especially in the practice of the work that I do. I really pay attention and champion those who find a way to kind of reimagine everyday ideas and give birth to them in a new way, or help people see. And I think that's really what creativity is. It's the ability to be ingenious and resourceful, but also caring and empathetic. At least that's how I see it. And I think everyone is able, or it's okay to have your own definition of creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. In my mind, the empathy part is almost a requisite, because to be able to be creative, you have to be able to understand what problem you're trying to solve. And if you're going to solve it in a way that hasn't been done before, you have to be able to understand the issues, the constraints, and the people you're dealing with. And that requires empathy. It requires the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes and live their problems in some way, vicariously, but still get that level of understanding. So I think empathy is hugely important.
Agreed.
So is there anything that gets you out of bed in the morning?
Yeah, my dog. Every day she comes and wakes me up. It's kind of this routine we have. But no, more importantly, you know, last October, I stepped out of my role at GFDA looking for something new. Having been there for 7 years, I felt like part of where I thrive is when I'm challenged and when I'm in a position where, you know, maybe there's a sense of fear of failure, something we touched on a little bit earlier. And in my role there, I really just felt perhaps too comfortable, and that the work had in some ways become too routine. Both my fault and the fault of just the job itself. But what gets me out of bed in the morning is often unknown. I don't know. I think I'm constantly now that I'm free of my previous venture, I'm constantly looking for what that will be next. So, and I think right now I'm in this exploratory phase where I'm trying to figure out if isn't really the answer, what it is. So I'm constantly looking and constantly trying to ask myself, what is it that gets me out of the bed in the morning? So I'm more or less in a state of re-examining my position and trying to establish that.
Do you have a timeline for the completion of that project, or you just go with the flow?
Actually, I'm just going with the flow. I take it. Here's what I do. I do it in 12-month intervals. So about every year, I check back in with myself if I haven't noticed anything specific. And I think I get that also from GFDA, because Brian and I never really had any serious contract with each other. We would have kind of this annual come to Jesus meeting where we'd sit down and say, you know, like, hey, man, how was that last year for you? It's like, good, good. How do you want to go about doing one more year? You know, it was like, yes or no was the only answer you could give. You couldn't do half a year. You couldn't do a month. You couldn't try it out. You were either 100% in or 100% out. And so in a lot of ways, I recognize I don't have full control over, you know, what I'm going to do or what kind of projects might come to me. But I'm definitely taking it a year at a time and kind of feeling it out. Really been on my own for 1 year. It's been an incredible ride. I've taken on a lot of projects that I've kind of been happy with, others that I've been like, whatever. And I think I'm still in that exploratory phase, as I said before, just trying to figure it out and take it as it comes.
Every year, do reassess where you're at. I think we all do it to an extent, but maybe not to the point where we actually like, do I really want to keep doing this? That's a very interesting and intriguing proposition. Outside of work, what do you do for fun, if anything, or do you work all the time?
I don't work all the time. I do work quite a bit. I think that's part of the practice that I set up for myself is that it is a practice, you know, and I think that's how I've always viewed it. And especially in the way that I talk about graphic design or just the practice of graphic design, it's really rooted in the way that I approach it. And that is, you have to spend time doing it and you have to spend time thinking about it. Outside of work, I still, you know, exercise some of my teaching skills with James Victoria. So I do go out and help him teach workshops from time to time. In addition to that, I don't know if I could call myself a surfer, but maybe definitely an amateur practicing surfer. So I'm, you know, when the weather's nice here in New York, there's definitely a surf scene, and I do find time to go on surf trips throughout the year. So I would say that I pretty frequently am out in the water. So that would definitely be my number one hobby. Other than that, tinkering, you know, just messing around with shit. Someone comes up with a great idea, collaborating on it with no sense of how, you know, getting anything in return. Just being there and being part of the ride.
Playing. Would you call that playing?
Playing. I would absolutely call that playing. Yeah, I guess I say practice, but maybe what I should be saying is play. I just, you know, I spend a lot of time just poking around, looking into things, coming up with ideas, deciding if that's something I should do or not do.
And it's been something that's been on my mind a lot, because there's more and more evidence that play, in the broadest sense of the term, which is unstructured activities, I don't know what the exact definition is, but actually is the best way to solve problems, be creative, and kind of move forward in life. And there's people that I really admire here in Toronto. They're called 21 Toys, and they created this toy called the Empathy Toy, which teaches people how to be empathetic with one another. I actually have it, and I use it in my workshops. It's quite interesting how it works. And they're huge proponents of play, because play is, I think it's the other side of the creativity coin. It's how you get serendipity to generate new solutions to old problems. And going back to play and hobbies, you were wondering if you could call yourself a surfer. I think if you can stand with your 2 feet on a board, you are a surfer. because otherwise I wouldn't be one. So I enjoy surfing. I'm not any good at it, but it's something I do whenever I get a chance. It's very fun activity. It's almost meditative. It's like motorcycling, surfing. There are two activities that cut you off from the world in some ways, because when you're on the water, you can't have your phone, you can't be on Instagram. There's none of that. You're just yourself in the water and maybe a few people around, but you're just focused on nature. And when you're riding motorcycles, the same thing. If you get any distraction, you're going to die. So you have to be super focused all the time. And I think those two activities are liberating in that sense.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I also think you could add running to that. And I think there's a common theme in all the hobbies that I have, is that they have to be challenging. They have to sometimes seem impossible. Both surfing and running definitely check those boxes. And I think there's a chance for you as an individual to succeed. You know, like when you run a race, you can't just ask someone to pitch in. You know, halfway through, it's you or nothing. I think I've always valued that experience as an individual.
When you run, do you have your headphones on?
No, I'm a masochist. I just like me, the air, and just, you know, pounding the pavement.
Because that's the thing. I think I run, and I'm not a huge runner, but I run occasionally, and I do it with music on. But I think that's actually a distraction. I think if I force myself to run without headphones, it might be more of a more mindful practice in that sense.
Yeah, definitely a mindful practice for me. I spend probably too much time thinking while I run. about everything I've been doing, working on, or dealing with. So,
but I would call that play too. In some sense, you play in your head with ideas, or you just let them flow. I meditate a lot, and when I can't focus on the meditative practice, my mind wanders away and it goes in all sorts of directions. But that's where I get great ideas too.
Yeah, that's where all the connective tissue kind of comes together, and where the ideas start to make sense, the time you spend away from them.
So the challenge is, when you meditate, is to remember those ideas until the end of your sitting. You can't really get up and write them down, right? That's too distracting. Is there something that, or some things that inspire you particularly?
They're definitely personal things, and I don't know that it matters, but I spend a lot of time looking at old ephemera and print ephemera. Could be, you know, old dictionaries, anything I can find that has a diagram. I don't really share these things with people. This is definitely like a personal hobby and an archive that I've kind of built over the years, where I actually document and store digitally all of the little nuanced pieces that I find. But I've been doing that for a number of years, and there's just something I really enjoy, like a native artifact and kind of the aesthetic and signs of how it was made are all baked into those really early pieces.
So when you say ephemera, what are you talking about exactly?
Mostly printed ephemera. So, you know, you go through a dictionary and you see, you know, maybe there's a photo with a dump truck and it's printed in a half tone. There's just something so beautiful about it. Maybe it's really, really, really tiny, but I can blow it up really, really, really big. I think that there's something about that. And part of me doesn't really know why I appreciate it. And I continue just to kind of collect it. And I think one day I'll figure out a use for them all. But for the time being, I just really enjoy that practice of clipping and saving and archiving.
It's almost like a digital scrapbook.
Yeah, it is somewhat scrapbookish.
I don't know if it's related, but it might be. Do you still send postcards?
I do, very, very often, actually.
Where do those come from? Do you just collect them, or you buy them in bulk, or what?
Yeah, anytime I see a box of postcards for sale, I usually buy all the ones I appreciate, regardless of price. As long as there's no writing on the back, for me, it's like, if in those moments those things speak to you, then you can't put a dollar amount on it. You should own it. And then if it means so much to you, you should also practice giving those things away. And I think I've found throughout my life that I've come to cherish objects, and then I've also challenged myself to give those objects to someone you care about, or just to get rid of them, whether you donate them or sell them, or, you know, find a new home for them. But I think that practice of giving those things away also provides value for us. I don't know if I can necessarily articulate it, but I definitely like to challenge myself.
So what do you get out of that regular practice of sending postcards to, I don't know if I can say random people, but because I got one from you, I think you put a call on Twitter or something, you said, you want a postcard? And then you just respond, say yes, and you send your address, and then you get a postcard a few days or a few weeks later. What do you get out of doing that with people you hardly know, or you maybe don't know at all?
Well, I get a few things. One of them is sometimes I hope they'll write me back. I'm curious what that does to the dialogue. And I think over time, more often than not, the people I've written postcards to, I've actually kept in touch with. So there are a handful of people that I think I've kind of put a foothold in a small relationship with them because they've taken the time to make them something. What it does for me is just personally gratifying. And that is that when people ask for that, I consider that a commission. And that's a reason to produce the work. And without reason, I feel like I'm serving nothing. And I actually really need that excuse to sit down and like execute something all the way through. And the energy I put in, I find is very nuanced and comes in bursts. And I like to do it when it feels natural. And when it becomes a chore or an effort, I usually put it all away and wait till the next day, or, you know, revisit it in a week or so. So I find that the work I produce for the postcards and both finding them and I don't know what you would call kind of making them my own, drawing all over them, you know, that's like a very cherished practice for me.
And so how much do you reckon the one I got is worth now?
Oh, at least a dollar. At least a dollar. It's amazing because in Ohio, postcards are 5 cents. Really, like they can't sell postcards, so they almost want to give them away. But in New York, those same postcards cost $1 to $3.
Because in New York, you have the tourists that are going to buy them, right?
Yeah, or you just have like, it's hip, you know, it's like there's a market for it. So when I'm in Ohio, I buy all the shoe boxes I can find with postcards, and I just throw out the ones that are like, you know, that I don't appreciate.
Is it more like going to garage sales and finding postcards, or do you go to stores and buy them from stores?
Anywhere that I find postcards for sale, usually they find me, but I if I'm in a store and I notice some, or garage sales or wherever, but anywhere they are, if I find them, I buy them.
And do you always draw over the postcards you send, or do you send some of them just as they are?
No, I always make them better, right? I think in some cases I have purchased postcards that have cost, you know, five, $10 maybe. And I think that's a lot of money. And then I go home and butcher it up. And there's a little bit of pressure because you're like, this is garbage, one. And now I'm going to try to make it better. And it has some perceived value to it. So there's the pressure of like, I only get one go at this. I got to make it good and it has to be right. So I think it's a practice in kind of balancing all of those feelings and emotions that you have when you're in the act of producing something.
Well, I've only seen one of those, but the one I have is quite fantastic because it's got my name and big black letters printed over whatever pictures is on the front. So that's gratifying, if nothing else.
Where is it right now? Is it?
It's in my living room. It's on my shelf because I get a bunch of postcards every year, especially around Christmas.
Yeah.
And usually after 6 months or so, I get rid of most of them. But I've had yours for a couple of years and I just can't. That's not something I can't throw away because it's not a generic corporate postcard like that everybody gets the same. So there's that element of uniqueness.
So I make the cut, in other words.
Yeah, and you're one of two or three because most of the other ones go to the trash. But I think it's also valuable to me because I have it's a little bit different, but I have a design poster collection
mm-hmm.
that's not on display anywhere. It's just basically a bunch of rolled up posters. But someday I will do something with this collection. And I think the postcard, even just as a small framed piece, would be like a great mini poster to have in my collection. But I want to show you this, or listeners won't be able to see it. But I got this postcard today from a client. They took Sgt. Pepper's album cover and plastered faces of all the employees instead of the Beatles and everybody else, and their friends and their colleagues. And my face is on it. It's too tiny.
They put you on it.
It's like, really small.
Yeah, look.
So that's one I'm going to keep too because that's become so personal. I think it's really cool, and I want to shout out DPAI because they're great people and they're great friends. But yeah, that's the kind of creativity I can really enjoy.
Yeah. Well done.
So what would be the biggest risk you've ever taken?
That's a great question. You know, I'm still young. I'm only in my 30s, so I can't really think of any serious risk other than maybe having moved to New York after living in Ohio for 28 years. After driving around the country in 2013, that was the first time I'd ever been to New York, and I absolutely hated everything about it. And at the time, Brian and I were trying to figure out where to take our business next. We had so many conversations about this. It was like a married couple trying to convince one or the other to move where they like the weather, right? And we just couldn't come to a solution that made sense for us. So eventually, I just said, I'm going to move to New York for a year and let's work our business remotely because eventually we're going to go remote or we're going to go to a new location. And this will give us a chance to kind of figure out what that could potentially look like. For us, it was a big risk because it could have ultimately destroyed our business. And it was a big risk for me because for the first time as an adult, I was really stepping out of the comfort zone that I'd created and the networks that I had built in Ohio and putting myself in a completely far more aggressive kind of New York market scenario culture, right?
Did you know anyone down there?
I knew quite a few people, but in my experience here, it takes like 3 to 6 months for people to finally recognize that, yes, you do live here, and no, you're not moving. I think at that point, then you start to make friends and really start to build relationships. But I definitely had the naive thought that the friends I had would immediately prosper into great relationships. But, you know, it's interesting. After you move anywhere, I think you find that friends are for a reason, season, or lifetime. And it might not always be lifetime just because of the fact that you're in proximity to them.
And they're more often seasoned in lifetime.
Yeah.
I've had a similar experience initially moving to Toronto, and that was 13 years ago, and then moving to Chicago almost 11 years ago. And I've been in Toronto long enough that I have some really solid friends, and probably a number of those would be lifetime friends. But Chicago, I've lived there for about 2.5-3 years. Can't say I've made many, many lifetime friends, maybe one or two.
Yeah.
And that's always been a really challenging thing for me because where I come from in France, I think it's a little easier to make lifetime friends. Or maybe I'm naive and I just had a different experience. But it was moving every 2 years for a while was extremely challenging in that regard.
I think you got to write more postcards.
Well, it's actually funny you say that because as you were talking about your postcards practice, I made a note on my to-do list to do that. I actually write postcards to people for in the context of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Like whenever I meet someone for the first time or maybe even for the second or third time, I always send a thank you note. But it's always on the same postcard. I just have like branded postcards with my address on it and I just write a little note on the back. While we were talking, I had the idea of printing maybe blank postcards and illustrating them on the front and then writing a little note on the back.
Yeah.
I think that would be really cool.
Yeah.
And then they'd become like mini pieces of art. So I want to talk a little bit about failure. What would be the biggest failure or failures so far that you've experienced?
I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I think early on, especially in the GFT experience, we had so many failures. You know, I think the whole story is basically just riddled with them. And after a while, even maybe after the very first experience, failures just became opportunities, and they became a chance for us to really start over, start fresh, and reexamine whatever path we had just taken. So in short, failures were experience, and experience is what you need to move forward.
So what would have been some of the lessons you've learned from those failures?
Are you talking philosophical lessons or very specific ones?
Philosophical or practical, whichever you want to talk about.
Yeah, you know, in the beginning, Brian and I signed every poster in the pre-sale. I think we had 400 posters. My signature changed by like poster number two, because I was just thinking, you know, my name is not the easiest to write. It's not very long, but it's just cumbersome. And writing it out that many times, I just knew it was taking too long. So everything started to streamline. That was a theme for a lot of what we did. That was definitely a practical learning. You said it earlier, but nobody knows what the fuck they're doing. I think that's a great thing you learn. And you learn it by going through those experiences and finding yourself in a situation where you have absolutely no idea how to solve a problem other than just continue to move forward on it. And eventually you'll either hit a wall or you'll blow right through it.
We're going on the last two or three questions, and I don't want to take too much of your time, so we can wrap up. But how full is your swear jar?
Oh, it's overflowing. No. I get a free pass because of who I am, and so does Brian. But swear jar was actually the last product that I brought to fruition before I left, and it was something that, again, just like all of our products, come by means of great conversations and emotional reactions to something, and just kind of this common sense over the head way of thinking. And it was just like, you know, we've helped people swear and overcome probably situations that really created a warpath of profanity for them, and it'd be really great if we could find a way to help them save their money and put all that in one place. So the swear jar seemed like a very practical tongue-in-cheek idea, but now my swear jar is empty. My vacation jar, on the other hand, is so full. I'm about ready to go on vacation here.
Oh, so how many jars do you actually have?
Just one. But that's really what it was modeled after.
So that's the vacation jar?
It's a vacation jar. Yeah, it's just a glass gallon growler with just handwriting. I just scripted vacation jar, just like your postcard. And then, you know, we took that same jar and saving idea and made the swear jar.
So you just go on vacation when that's full?
Yeah. Yeah, eventually you reach the top and you have to empty it out. That's just an excuse to do it.
So how often do you empty it out?
I've been saving for 5 years now, and I'm almost to the top. So I'll let you know when I haven't gone anywhere. Apparently, it takes a little longer than 5 years.
To fill out a gallon?
To fill out a gallon and a half, I think.
So that, yeah, I can't imagine how much money is in there.
Yeah, I also think the increased use of debit and credit card transactions has reduced the number of contributions to the vacation jar, because, like, you know, I just don't have a lot of spare change lying around.
I have a trick for that I've been using for years. Is for every like common daily personal expense, I always have cash, and I pay for 95% of food and coffees and groceries, whatever. I pay cash, so I always have change that I can then put in my saving jar, which is probably bigger than your growler. It's one of those giant tub of protein powder. I had a honey jar full of coins. I emptied it in the tub, and the tub is like not even a half inch full. Like, that thing is going to take 25 years to fill up.
Yeah, but that'll be a hell of a vacation.
No, I think it might just go in my investment account instead, because I don't plan on waiting 25 years to go on vacation. I want to do a little mental exercise with you and picture yourself on your deathbed, hopefully many years from now. What would be the legacy that you'd like to leave behind?
The legacy that I'd like to leave behind is helping people get where they want to go. I think I get that from being a teacher and why I fell in love with education really early on, but helping people see and find whatever it is they want to pursue or get better at whatever they're doing. That would be the legacy I'd want to leave behind.
In the same vein, where do you want to go?
Anywhere that helps me achieve that legacy.
That's a great answer. Very inspirational.
Yeah.
The last question I have for you is a little more lighthearted. Stones or Beatles? And I want to add specifically for you that CCA is an acceptable answer.
CCR, Creedence Clearwater.
CCR, yeah.
Yeah, well, I would take out of those two, I would take the Beatles, only because I discovered them before the Stones. And I think that really marks an interesting time in my youth growing up. And the friend of mine at the time who introduced me to him was a great pal of mine. I actually haven't talked to him in many, many years. I'd love to get in touch with him. I cannot find this person. He introduced me to the Beatles, and it was really interesting seeing his passion for them. And I think I followed suit. But of course, Creedence Clearwater Revival is the band of choice. And I think that their music really, they capture an era of U.S. history that's authentic and speaks volumes to what was going on during those times. Times that I'll never experience myself because I'm not from that generation, but I do appreciate the honesty.
I'm more of a Stones person, but I discovered CCR 2 or 3 years ago and I downloaded their entire catalog. And there's some really, really good stuff in there, like just so unique.
Yeah, it really is. John Fogerty.
What's your favorite CCR song?
Bad Moon Rising. I mean, it's overplayed, but when it comes on, it does. It, like, I think great music takes you somewhere, and that song just takes me to a place that's personal and exciting and reminds me of a lot of really great memories that I had.
Yeah, it's a great song. I personally, and I don't know if it's by virtue of what I do, but Penthouse Popper is my favorite.
Penthouse Popper, classic.
Yeah, the title just does it for me.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, that's the end of this interview. I really had a ton of fun in speaking with you, and I'm hoping that we can continue a conversation at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you having me on, and I did my best to answer your questions. They were tough. They were tough. Gives me a lot to think about, and I appreciate you taking the time as well.
It's my pleasure. You did a great job.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Hey again, Arno here. If you liked this interview, be sure to give us a review on SoundCloud or iTunes. This episode was produced by Revelator Studio with music by Bounce Trio. To be notified of upcoming episodes, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Revelator_TO or sign up for our newsletter on our website at rvltr.studio. Keep on supporting creativity and never stop kicking fear in the nuts. Till next time, ciao.